history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, the stories that are there, so often untold, are worth the time it takes for us to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so the rest of us never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, the perspective we pick up is oh so powerful. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Hometown Heroes has never been and never will be a political program. The personal views of the veterans you hear on this show can range from the far left to the far right and everything in between. And they all realize that that's part of what they were fighting for so many years ago, the freedom to express those views. They also know, and boy have they made this point clear over the years, that perhaps the most crucial factor in America leading the Allies to victory in World War II and the defeat of tyrannical forces that sought to dominate the globe was the incredible unity that coalesced behind that effort. It wasn't that political differences and disagreements didn't exist. It was that our country had been attacked and its very ideals and existence were in jeopardy. So 16 million Americans ended up in uniform, millions more, men, women, and children supporting them in any way they could back home until that victory was finally achieved 75 years ago. I'm emphasizing that up front this week because so much of the national discussion this week has centered around a presidential debate that was not our finest moment. We can all see and feel the division and the rancor. It bombards us every day. And sometimes we may feel helpless to do anything about it. But one thing we can do is focus on more uplifting examples to emulate. And when I learned this week of the passing of two of the veterans we've met on this show, two men whose stories really underscore how fragile life can be and whose legacies reflect courage, sacrifice, and selflessness, those are the characteristics that our nation exemplified during World War II. And at other times in our history. And perhaps it becomes easier for the rest of us to follow that example when we take some time to soak it up. So that's what we're going to do this week, starting with some of the memories of Ralph Thiessen, who just finished his race at the age of 95. His father had served in World War I, and Ralph, the fourth of 10 children, would be one of six brothers to serve in our armed forces. Here's what he recalled about December 7th, 1941, in Chowchilla, California.
Well, we were playing basketball, practicing.
So someone came in the gym and told you what happened, or what?
No, I heard it at home, and I had to take my brother. He was hitchhiking to Fresno, going to school at Fresno State.
Was that shocking news? Did you understand what had happened or what it was going to mean?
Yeah, I hadn't realized what was happening. Although I didn't know here about Hawaii too much until then.
Yeah, it wasn't even a state yet.
No.
How did you see life changing after that?
Well, I decided I wanted to go into the Navy, and a good friend of mine in high school was Tom Begley. Tom and I went into service. Tom went to the Marines, and I went to the Navy, and I boarded the Saratoga in Bremerton, Washington. And one day in the dining line, Tom was way in the back, and I turned around, and I said, well, it sure looks like Tom Begley. So I went back, and it was. And I didn't expect him. I thought he just came aboard because some come on and just help or got fired. They got a fire signature that you take when somebody's welding or something like that. And so I had Tom come to dinner with me and Sarah, and we started talking about old times. And I'd go up there and visit him, and the Marines are brilliant, really nice. I enjoyed being around them.
And so everybody understands. So you and Tom in high school were pretty close,
mm-hmm.
But you're in the Navy. He's in the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to a lot of guys. I mean, I've talked to a lot of guys who went to sign up together with the hopes that, hey, if I sign up with my buddies, we're all going to go to the same place. We'll get mm-hmm. to be in the war together. And it never worked out that way for him. And here you go in the Navy, he goes in the Marines, and you end up on the same ship?
Mm-hmm.
How is that possible?
I don't know. His sister was glad that we were together.
Yeah, what do you need to tell me about his sister?
Well, she was a school teacher. Very lovable person. I dated her for quite a few years. She was a Baptist, I was Catholic, so didn't work out.
But she thought highly of you. So when you're heading off to sea, she was writing you letters and stuff?
Oh, yeah.
And then her brother, your buddy Tom, ends up on the same ship as you, just one of a handful of Marines on this giant carrier with a ton of sailors.
Mm-hmm.
That had to be a kind of a mind-blowing moment when you see him in that line.
I did. Oh, I was in line when I seen him back there.
Yeah?
I motioned him to come have lunch with us. He did. But I thought maybe he was just coming in for a work detail because we did have Marines come in for that. Mm. So it's nice. I'm going to be stationed aboard the Sarah.
And let's talk about the Sarah. So the Saratoga was a very historic aircraft carrier. I mean, and some people don't realize that in the breadth of World War II, from 41 to 45, the carriers at the start of the war were a far cry from the carriers they were bringing in at the end of the war.
Well, the Saratoga was carrier number three. We did a lot of, over in Hawaii, we trained a lot of pilots there because it was a big carrier. And I had seen a couple of guys go on a drink, but they got out all right. The ships that we did, they wouldn't anchor us together because we get in a fight once in a while with the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one time when we docked and they had us all go stand in line to get our maneuver out in this town. And we got together and had to kind of protect each other. Because we're pretty sure there'd be some fights otherwise.
So the guys from the Big E didn't like the guys from the Sarah?
My first of two.
Uh-huh. Well, good thing you both decided you were fighting the Japanese and not each other.
Right.
Both of those ships had quite a history.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk about your duties.
I was a water king, which is something that not too many guys in the Navy know about. Mm-hmm. I kept track of the ship's water. And when I left the boiler room, that's where I went. I left the soundings back of the boiler. If the smoke was coming out of the smokestack, I'd be up on top and watching it. I'd have to tell the boiler down below that they're smoking to clear it up.
If general quarters ever sounded, what would you have to do?
I was to go down to this machine area, and we had our pumps down there to put out the fires, wherever they are, and I run that pump. Probably on that one time when we got hit by the Japanese kamikazes.
Five kamikazes on the same day, causing great loss of life, including the life of your friend Tom.
A casual observer might say, hey, if you're going to be in the Marine Corps in World War II, you're probably a lot safer being on an aircraft carrier than storming the beaches at Tarawa or Iwo Jima or Okinawa or something like
right.
that. But that's not how it worked out for him.
No, it didn't.
And he had some kind of premonition of this?
He did. We went to an island called Ulithi, and there was a large number of ships out there. I mean, there's probably a couple thousand.
Right.
And so we took off from there. We went to Japan and hit Japan for a couple of days, and then we went to Iwo Jima.
As this is going on, Tom is expressing to you that he doesn't think he's ever going to make it back home?
And that's what he did. We were on the gun mount, and he's talking, and he said, I'm not coming home. I said, what? And I'm surprised him telling me that. I told him, I just said, Tom, are you going home? I said, no. So he said, tell my parents I love them. And my sisters, he had two sisters. I love them also. That was it.
And had you guys encountered kamikaze attacks before?
No, that's the first one.
So tell me about that day. How did that unfold for you?
Well, we went in lockdown, and the next morning I got up and I said, I got to go to the Marine Corps. I heard some of the Marines had gotten killed. So I went up to his apartment, and the Marine up there told me he knew I was a friend of Tom's. He said, Tom didn't make it. And I couldn't believe it.
If there's more you want to say about that, I don't want to stop you. But tell me about the attack itself. How many kamikazes attacked the Saratoga, and where were you while that was going on?
I was down in the room running the pumps if I had to.
So general quarters sounded, you knew you were under attack?
Right.
So you're down there waiting for orders of...
Yeah, one of them run the pumps when we put the fires out and start putting bodies on the flight deck where there's space to bury them at sea.
I'm just reading what you and your wife put together here. The Japanese attack began with fighter planes and kamikaze planes coming through the low cloud cover, and the insufficient escorts made the Saratoga a vulnerable target. After 3 hours and 17 minutes of fighting, 25 to 30 incoming planes, 7 bombs, and 5 kamikazes hit the ship. And this says, the old lady quivered from stem to stern as the flight deck and hull absorbed the beating. 7 bombs and 5 kamikazes. I mean, I've talked to guys where one kamikaze hit them, and it hit them in the right spot, and that was enough.
All right.
So you're in the fire room on the port side of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the fire room on the starboard side of the ship?
Well, they got hit. It was the fire room 7. There's a few of them killed there. In fact, they put these 3 bodies on the hangar deck and covered them up. And I did look at them. Somebody pulled the sheets back. And one was the chief, and I don't know what the other guys were.
But if you had been in that fire room,
I wouldn't be here.
Yeah. So basically the identical station on the other side of the ship is taken out. And this damage from all those bombs and the kamikazes, it's 7 bombs and 5 kamikazes. That's a lot of damage. Did you go topside and see that damage, see what had happened to your ship?
Not at the time, no. I see them pictured, but I didn't go up there. In fact, after the battle, I was washing blood off the air intake.
How'd the blood get there?
Some guys came down that way that were injured. Those are the guys I helped get out.
But if someone knocks on that hatch, you're not supposed to open it.
Right. It's clogged down. They came down from the air intake.
Uh-huh.
And that's how the blood got on it. I see they were bleeding. One guy was bleeding. So I took him to a place where they could go in the hallway and would go to where their first aid was.
Mm-hmm.
A few guys said, you weren't supposed to do that. Yep.
Those guys' lives depended on it. You were going to do it, huh?
Yeah.
How scary was that to hear all this going on above you, then to see some of the wounded coming down? I mean, were you worried that your ship was going to go down? Were you worried that you were going to get killed?
I wasn't too worried. I don't know why. I just didn't think about it.
Mm-hmm. So that battle starts at 5 o'clock at night. It's over before 8:30. So it's nighttime. You said you're cleaning the blood off the air intake. How'd you sleep that night?
Well, a long time ago. I thought a lot about Tom and wondered whether he made it. And like I said, the next morning I went to Marine's quarters and they told me.
I know, like you said, that was a long time ago. And you're an 18-year-old kid. But can you help us understand what that felt like? What that moment was like when they tell you Tom died? Tom was killed?
Oh, you know, you're shook up. A number of things enter your mind. And I thought about Tom. I said, the first thing I got to do is see him and find out he's not there.
And you mentioned a burial at sea.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just Tom. It was 123 guys from your ship that you guys had to bury at sea.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring you all topside for that ceremony?
I was appointed to clean the liver intake, so I didn't get to go.
So you weren't up there to watch it?
I didn't go up there. I was busy washing blood off the walls.
Probably would have been hard to be up there for that.
It would have been.
You've got a couple pictures of him right here.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see these pictures of Tom,
mm-hmm.
what comes to mind? What kind of guy was he?
Oh, you couldn't beat him. He's one of the best guys I ever met.
Have you ever wondered over the years, ever found yourself thinking, here's what Tom would have done with his life? Here's mm-hmm. the kind of person he would have been?
Yeah, he'd been a good farmer. He was smart, very smart.
And there were 123 men killed that day in that attack, almost 200 more wounded. Were there other friends of yours or people that you knew that were killed?
Not on the Saratoga. I more or less kept to my apartment. By the time I'd get out, I'd go to get my food for the day.
So what about after that? They probably had to repair your ship a little bit.
Yeah, we did a little repair shop, a little repair on the ship when we was in Pearl Harbor before we went to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
They did find that one pilot went through there under the hangar deck and caught all the plane on the flying deck on fire that we had on there.
Mm-hmm. When you look at those pictures, I mean, there are some pictures of the Saratoga during this attack, flames going everywhere and destroyed planes, body parts, guns that are torn up, the flight deck itself with big ruts and rips in it. You ever look at those pictures and say, how did I survive that?
Not really. I knew I was coming home, but, and so I wasn't too scared about it. The only thing I like to say is my buddy getting killed.
How'd you know you were coming home?
I didn't think anything about it. I knew I was coming home. At least I thought I would.
Where do you think that came from?
Oh, maybe my dad.
Because he came home from World War I, or he just raised you to think that way?
I was thinking that gave me some confidence in some things.
What about carrying out that promise that you made to Tom?
I did go see his folks.
When was that?
Right when I got home. I was a little late in getting off the ship because they took the starboard side off first, and then they took the port side off.
Mm-hmm.
So it was about a couple of weeks before I got home.
That must have been a really hard thing to do.
I did write her a letter.
You wrote his sister a letter?
Yeah, and I told her it was going to be the hardest letter I ever wrote, and it was.
What did you say in the letter?
I told her how sad I was to have her brother killed, and about one-page letter that I wrote on. And I think she still has a letter.
But then you get back to Chowchilla, and your war is over. You don't have to fight anymore, but you have to go see his parents.
Yeah, I did. Lavita and Tom's girlfriend came to our place, and I'd take a little while before I went and seen him, and I told her more about Tom. I think about it, but I say every day I'm reminded over there with that Kodak.
Yeah, so you've got, right next to your favorite chair, you've got one of those digital picture frames. So it'll rotate through as many pictures as you can stick on there.
Mm-hmm.
And how often does Tom's face come up on there?
It comes up every day.
Every day?
Yeah. In the morning, hi, Tom.
It is his family's fervent belief that on September 23rd, 2020, Ralph Thiessen was able to say, hi, Tom, again, and be reunited with the friend he had lost 75 years earlier. Our thoughts and prayers are with Ralph's wife of 68 years, Noreen, and the entire Thiessen family. It's time for a break, but there's more to come on this special tribute edition of Hometown Heroes, remembering two of the more than 16 million Americans who served our country during World War II. We'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special tribute episode today. As we witness the challenges in our country today that threaten to divide us even further, perhaps we can draw inspiration from the selfless examples of our World War II veterans, including the two men we're remembering today. Two men who always brought perspective to family and friends with what they had to overcome in their combined 195 years on Earth. Patch Curtis passed away this week, a little more than 6 months shy of his 100th birthday. He was an only child growing up on an Arizona ranch that his grandparents had homesteaded, but that only child left behind 51 descendants when he finished his journey on Earth. None of them would exist if not for the heroic efforts that saved his life in the Philippines 75 years ago. Patch had tried to enlist in the Marine Corps the day after the attack on Pearl Harbor, but was rejected for being nearsighted. 8 months later, he was drafted into the Army and spent the next couple years training soldiers stateside. That whole time, he had a lingering desire to go overseas and fight, and he shared with us why.
The compelling reason was this. When I was at the boarding house in October of 1941, after I got home from work, there was a message on my bed and said, call Willard Pearson in San Francisco at this number. He was a former neighbor, a next-door neighbor from where the house I was born, Mr. and Mrs. Pearson, Willard, and his younger sister, Virginia. Virginia was a year older than I was. We were chums, so we kind of grew up more or less together. Anyway, I went over and saw Willard, and he and his wife were in a hotel room in San Francisco with their little son, Mike. They had been given a two-month vacation in the States from their job in the Philippines. They were working for the Itaogan Mine Corporation in Baguio, P.I., Philippine Island.
Right.
Baguio was up on the north end of Luzon. I went over and visited one night with them, and I went back for the second visit with them. And Mr. and Mrs. Pearson were still in the Philippines, and Virginia had married a mining engineer from Canada, and he was also working in the same mine there. And Willard and his wife were going back. Well, they finally got their boat and went back. But that was October 1941. On December 8th, the Japanese picked him up and put him in prison camp, the whole family. So should I help if I can? Yes, I should.
So while you're in the Army and you're training these guys and all that, you're aware that your friends are prisoners in the Philippines.
That's right.
So your desire was to go to that part of the war and do what you could to set him free.
That's right. Was put on a 20,000-ton Victory model troop transport that had about 2,000 guys on it. We didn't know where we were going at that time, but we went out under the Golden Gate Bridge and so on. And 19 days later, we made landfall at Milne Bay, right on the southern tip of New Guinea. We were told that we were supposed to go up the coast to Oro Bay, and we were be unloaded there. And Oro Bay happened to be a replacement center for the Southwest Pacific at that time. So there were hundreds of us off at Oro Bay there. We spent our days there unloading ships with supplies and all that kind of stuff while we were waiting for assignment to whatever unit we would be assigned to. One of my tent mates was Roy Dunlap. Roy and I struck it off great because he'd been a target shooter back in Illinois, and he had trained as a gunsmith in one of the foremost gunsmith shops in the U.S. He later turned out to be a custom gunsmith and built custom guns down in Tucson, Arizona. His largest order were 30 special 6.5 guns for the Olympic shooting team. Roy and I both were assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division and were put on a ship and went up to Los Negros Island in the Admiralty Group. Roy was assigned on the initial landing group to go on up, and I was assigned to the group to stay on Los Negros and finish up. I didn't get to Leyte until November the 20th. They made the initial landing on Leyte October the 20th. I was assigned to the Troop B, 7th Cavalry. They had been in action, and they were in a replacement center, and I was one of the replacements that they got where they had lost from the action they'd been in. We were there for 5 days getting acquainted with my new squad, and were put on trucks and trucks from Natunga, about center on the northern end of Leyte, and we were transported across to the northwest corner of Leyte at a place called Carriguera. We were offloading the trucks on the beach at Carriguera. That's where we formed up and headed up the Sugud Road across a place named Limon, up on the top of the mountain, heading south toward Ormoc, where the main body of the Japanese were. But in the meantime, the Japanese were in control of all of this road net off and on all the way south of Carriguera.
At the time we offloaded, there was a battery of 455 long toms firing across the island from Karagara Beach down to Ormoc, which was about 20-some miles. These 155-millimeter shells at Limon, we were right under the path of those bullets going over. Every time a salvo of four shells would go across, it would sound like a freight train going through the air over you. We had a tragic result there. These shells are 6 inches in diameter and they weigh 90 pounds. And the driving band to seal the gas as they go through the barrel is copper alloy that's driven into a dovetail around the base of the shell. Once in a great while, one of those will split and tear off due to the centrifugal rotation of the shell. It's thrown off at rather high speed. We had drained the top of the road at this place named Limon, and we were all laying down out of breath, catching our breath and so on. And one of these salvos went over, and one of the guys about four rows over, I heard a big, ugh! And looked over to see what happened. One of these rotating bands had came off and come down and cut him in two right to the spine.
Mm.
So that was our first close scrape of combat. But that afternoon we went on down our slope and we had a firefight that afternoon down at the creek. We didn't suffer any casualties there, but we scored a few. We camped there, and that was the last drill of fresh water that we saw for the next 5 days. And the next morning, my squad was appointed point, and we went up a muddy trail. I could still see the footprints with water running back into it, for somebody was going up this muddy trail ahead of us. So I sent word back that we were right on the Japanese trail. Sure enough, about 15 or 20 minutes later, a guy pops out from behind the bush. I started delivering off shots with my M1 and stepped over to the left. My BAR man let go at him, and he was only less than the distance between me and Cindy there.
10 feet or so, less.
And we got out of that one okay, but he had turned out to be the equivalent of a major in rank, and he had a tremendous flag with hundreds and hundreds of signatures on it, and I got that flag. Next memorable thing was the Christmas morning, the dawn nice and clear with a lot of sparkling water drops that had rained during the night, and the sun as it came up on those just made every little glot of water look like a gleaming diamond, and the air was fresh and so on. But we missed our airdrop. There wasn't any food that day. All we had to eat that day was what we had in our pack, and all I had in my pack was one tropical chocolate bar.
I gotta ask you though, I mean, you've had a lot of years since then. You're talking about 1944. We're going to be coming up on Christmas 2017 before long. Has there been a Christmas since then where you didn't think about being back there in the Philippines on that Christmas morning with nothing to eat?
Never.
Gave you some perspective, huh?
Sure does.
And in a moment like that, do you think of family back home? Do you wonder if you're ever going to see them again?
Not really. You're so preoccupied with what you're confronted with right then, you hardly have a chance for daydreaming.
Every guy gives me a different response. Some people say, hey, I thought I was invincible. It was going to happen to everybody else and not me. Other guys say, I just knew at some point, you know, it was going to be me. Did you have a feeling one way or the other? I mean, were you scared? Were you concerned that you weren't going to get out of this?
Every time you're on the point, you're scared. Your adrenaline is pumping. You're scared. You're apprehensive. Is it now or...
Sure. There's nobody in front of you.
Right.
It's you and the enemy.
That's me and it.
And that was a familiar position for you? Something that you were doing regularly?
Pretty often, because they traded this point thing equal amongst the squad.
And you have an x-ray sitting right here that I'm going to make sure we get a picture of and put at hometownheroesradio.com. This is a recent x-ray, and it shows some souvenirs that you're still carrying all these years later. But before you got hit, before you were wounded, were there some other moments that you look back on now and say, hey, that was pretty close too?
Well, almost every one of those situations you get into, you say, got through that one. One of the other peculiar things is that me or him, Shorty Barrett comes to mind. Shorty Barrett was a fellow squad leader. The platoon sergeant was talking to us, giving us a kind of assignments and so on. And Shorty got hit in the chest, and he went down.
How far away was he from you when that happened?
Well, 3 feet.
If they could hit him, they easily could have hit you.
Oh, easy, sure. Any one of us could have got it. But the peculiar thing about it is, after we got up on Luzon several months later, and Shorty got through his chest wound and came back, we were called together for the same reason, the same way. And who got hit? Shorty.
Twice.
Twice.
Did he survive that one too?
I don't know. I never heard. We never heard anything from him that time.
And Luzon is where you received your wounds.
Yeah. This is really the one dramatic wartime scene that you could ever see went off on the day that I got wounded. I was taken out on March 8th, 1945. On the 6th, these big B-24 bombers began. We were all lined up down on a road at the foot of the mountains. The Yamashita line was the objective, and the town we wanted to get was Antipolo. On the 6th, the B-24s would come over in strings of three and drop 500 and 1,000-pound bombs on Antipolo and the Japanese fortifications that they could identify in that area. They came over a good part of the 6th and a good part of the 7th, off and on all day long, dropping these bombs. And we were a good 3-4 miles from there. But every time one of those 1,000-pound bombs would go off, your helmet would go like this on your head.
Rattle around a little.
4 or 5 miles away. Oof. Anyway, that went on. And then on the morning of the 8th, we were given instructions that there were going to be a 3-division push on Antipolo starting on 8 o'clock on March the 8th. No one had watches anymore because in the tropics and everything, watches and cameras just didn't, they just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
They just, the bands had rot off, so hardly anyone knew what time it was. But the 6th Division on the north, the 1st Cavalry Division in the center, and the 41st Division on the right. And if they're all in full strength, that would be 45,000 men. But to give you an idea, my squad was down 2 men. There was only 6 or 7 of us where there should have been 9. That was permitted all 3 of the division because we'd all been in combat for a couple of months and we had lost a lot of people for this reason and for that.
Sure.
Mostly illness and just being completely worn out. But the first thing that happened, an A-20A attack plane with a smoke started and they just laid a smoke screen 10 miles across the face of that mountain. They had 4.2 chemical mortars set up in intervals all down through that 10-mile section firing red smoke shells. And as these red shells would go up, they were spaced apart. Each unit was supposed to stay in that line that was delineated by these smoke lines. So when they made the blackout, these red lines started up, and we were given the order to go. So we went ahead. And our particular assignment that day was to take a artillery observation unit from a 155-millimeter howitzer battery and place them on their optimum observation point. We were supposed to escort them up and get them put down on the place where they were supposed to direct the fire from their battery. I had been on patrol in that day before and was most familiar with the area that they wanted to go traverse, so I was appointed point. So we started out at 8 o'clock up through the smoke screen after the massive artillery barrage went off ahead of us, and as we went up, the ground was filled with craters 12 to 18 inches deep. Ground looked like it had just been plowed with these shells, but we went on up, and when I say up, it was the base of a mountain, and it, as you went further up, it got steeper and steeper and steeper.
Sure.
We were pretty successful and didn't receive too much resistance, and only a couple of firefights on the way up. Till about 11 o'clock, we got up down a particular area. We ran into some resistance. The unit commander decided the best way to subdue the Japanese was we had a bazooka section that would fire bazooka shells, a 60-millimeter mortar section, and so they fired up all the bazooka shells. The Japs still continued to fire back at us. All of the mortar shells got used up trying to knock them out, so there weren't any more mortar shells available. So finally, platoon sergeant said to me, "Curtis, take your squad down and see if you can knock them out with grenades."
What happened next would come very close to costing him his life. There are 51 descendants who are very thankful for how it worked out as they remember Patch Curtis's life this week. The original motivation for starting this program was to preserve stories like this so families could remember them long after our World War II veterans are gone. And we're going to get to hear, in his own words, what Patch experienced on March 8, 1945, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, "One of these days I'm going to do something with those"? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode this week remembering two special men who just reached the finish line in their time on this planet. It could have come 75 years earlier for both of them, but they both felt there was a reason it did not, and the last three quarters of a century proved it with the lives they led and the examples they set. When we left off, we were hearing Patch Curtis's memory of March 8, 1945. A Japanese position in Antipolo on the island of Luzon in the Philippines had withstood bombardment from mortars and bazookas, and Patch was told to take a squad close enough to neutralize the enemy with grenades.
We were up on the lee side of a hill where they couldn't get to us, so I went down the backside and around, and it was kind of an open swale down and a hill up on the backside over here, and I went around. I made sure all of them had four grenades and full belt of ammo and so on. Well, I started out with them down and went around and headed around here, and I said, "Let's pick up the pace. We don't want to be standing around too slow and make a good target." And so we started kind of moving a little faster, and we were firing as we were advancing. And one of my guys stumbled and went down, and as he went down, he almost hit me. He was pulling off shots as he fell down, and I turned and said, "You almost hit me. Get up." And he was down on his hands and knees like this. I kicked him in the behind, and he greatly started to get up and so on. And by then, the first bullet hit me over on the left shoulder here, and I figured, well, we were stopped. We were in wide open space, and we're not moving anymore. We're dead meat. So I started to turn to say, "Let's get out of here." And that's when the bullet hit me in the chest here.
What did that feel like?
It knocked the breath out of me, and I went down on my back. It spun me around. I couldn't get my breath. A fleeting thought went to me, "Well, I guess this is it." But for some reason, I got my breath a little bit. Somehow, I got initial shock. I guess my heart stopped or something, too. I don't know. But anyway, a guy grabbed me by one leg and pulled me back around this point of this little hill and so on. I don't know how they got me back up on the top of the hill in the back. I was unconscious by then. I woke up. I remember the aid man was working on me, and they were giving me some morphine. And I remember when I'd breathe, it was going like that, and I had tried to get my hand over here to close it up.
So you could tell that your lung was punctured?
Well, I didn't know. It just hurt, and I couldn't get my heart to get my breath. I was real short of breath, and I was coughing a little bit, and I was in and out after that. But when one incident, I woke up, and my fellow squad leader, a fellow by the name, my last name was Carmona, he had me in his lap, and the aid man had told him to keep my shoulder up so I wouldn't drown in my own blood. So he was kind of holding me up in his lap, and I heard, "For Christ's sake, Carmona, take your carbine and shoot me. I can't stand this pain." He says, "Well, I'll get the aid man to give you some more morphine." And The aide man, Andy Anderson, he said, I can't give you any more. It'll stop your breathing. So I said to Carmona, take your carbine and shoot me. I can't stand this pain. So that was about 11 o'clock in the morning as they, later on, they were able to kind of tell me. That went on all the rest of that day. They wanted to get a stretcher party up, but the Japanese had moved in on the trail behind, and they couldn't bring anybody here. No ammunition or anything. They couldn't get anything up to us. They were still in radio communication with the rear, but they couldn't make physical contact because the Japanese had intervened. And they decided that maybe after dark they could circumvent the Japanese. So sometime after dark, they got a stretcher party up there to get me in. And they had took six guys on the stretcher to get me down off of there. So I didn't get down to the 1st Medical Squadron Station till somewhere around midnight. And I remember one instance on the stretcher on the way down. I was in and out all the time, but one instance, a problem that I got kind of aroused. They couldn't figure out how to get me down off this level, but somehow they did. They laid us out in the yard before they finally got me into a surgeon, and all I can remember, somebody woke me up enough to say that I was getting my first blood transfusion. They showed me the name on the bottle there, and they read it off to me. Gaeus, G-A-Y-E-O-U-S. Gately, G-A-T-E-L-E-Y. Anyway, that was the first blood transfusion that I got.
And what all did they have to do surgically for you?
They didn't really do much except took out quite a few pieces. They reconstructed, later on they told me, what apparently had happened. I had a pair of binoculars on, and the bullet hit the binoculars first and disintegrated partially. So in the stuff that they took out of me was the pieces of binocular castings, piece of glass, leather from my wallet that was in my chest pocket here, piece of paper from stuff that was in the wallet, bullet fragments, and some of the bullet fragments they wrapped up. Here's the dog tags. That's all I got back with.
You were wearing these?
That's what I had on at the time.
You had this dog tag on at the time, and you've saved it with the leather strap.
And it's still blood-soaked, and that shoestring is still soaked with my blood.
Wow.
And they were finding all that stuff in me, so apparently the bullet fragment, there's one large piece about as big as my thumbnail still down underneath there, and with that adhesive tape that's wrapped around them there that you see, they had a piece of the bullet fragments that they had found in the outer layers of skin there. All those pieces of stuff that you see shattered through there,
yeah,
that's a good part of that is binocular.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't, the binocular hadn't been on there, it's very likely the bullet would have gone through much cleaner.
And not spread out so much debris in there.
Yeah.
And they had to take out a couple of your ribs?
Yeah, that happened a year and some months after. These two ribs that they took out wouldn't heal. They developed osteomyelitis, and they were getting worse and worse.
But basically the whole right side of your chest
is
crushed, destroyed, bruised.
Right.
Your lung was damaged.
Right. The first operation, they didn't think there was anything in the lung. It was collapsed. And when the lung collapses, apparently a hard coating forms on there. And they have to strip all that. They called it a decortication operation. They stripped that off before the lung can re-expand. Apparently they did that, but apparently there was still stuff in there because in January of 1946, I started coughing up blood. They couldn't figure out what that was, but they took a lot of pictures and stuff in there. Again, the Veterans Administration was completely overwhelmed. They couldn't find a bed to put me in. They wanted to send me up to some hospital way up in Oregon, and I didn't want to go up there because I didn't know anybody. I had the job down there that I thought I would, because I went back to work on January the 1st.
Well, wait a second, though. You went back to work, but I know that one of the other effects of that injury, at least in the immediate aftermath, was you really didn't have the use of your right arm, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, what kind of state were you in for the next few weeks after you got hit?
Initial medical help.
Yeah.
I was transferred to the 41st Field Hospital in Quezon City. That was a place to get your feet back underneath of you and get a little weight going back and so forth. And I was there for several weeks. They moved us down on the docks in Manila and put us on a hospital ship for a general hospital down in New Guinea, back at Hollandia. I was on this hospital ship on April the 10th, my birthday, on the 12th of April, and the day that President Roosevelt died. That came in over the radio, that President Roosevelt. And then I wound up down in this 54th General Hospital in Hollandia for quite a while. That's where my arm wasn't working.
And when you say it wasn't working, you had no control of it all or no strength?
It was cold. I couldn't lift it. I could feel some. I could move my fingers and so on, but I couldn't do anything with them.
Because there was muscle damage from the shot you
right.
received.
And they also said there was probably some nerve damage,
sure,
which disappeared. That problem disappeared later on.
I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this and they're thinking, well, how long did it take them to recover? And that's probably not a simple question, because in some ways you probably never recovered.
Yeah, that's right.
You've had to live the last 70 years without full respiratory function?
Right. I'm short 50% of my normal air.
How has that affected your everyday life?
It was entering as at work, you know. These eager beaver bosses, you know, when they make a factory tour, they go out at full stride, you know. If I was in one of these parties, you know, by the time we'd get about halfway through a department, I would go and everybody would go, what's the matter with this guy? One other interesting aspect to this mental, I was walking down the aisle one day by the acetylene welding department, and you know when you hang acetylene torch up once in a while, it goes pop, 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 pop. I was walking by, this guy hung up his torch there, and it went pop, 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 and I found myself under this workbench over here.
You thought you were back in the jungle of the Philippines dodging bullets, huh?
Yeah, just like that.
And the other thing I've got to say, I don't want to be melodramatic, but we talked about your four kids and 13 grandkids and 30 great-grandkids and a great-great on the way. And after hearing your story, it sure seems like it's a miracle that any of them were ever born, because most people wouldn't have survived what you went through, and it sounds like it took a lot of help from a lot of other people to save your life.
That's absolutely true. I've had help all of my life, and that's another thing I marvel at. My grandmother picked me up after my mother died. My friends in San Francisco picked me up after I lost my place on the ranch. On and on and on and on.
And those guys had to drag you out of the spot where you got hit.
Yeah.
And they're risking their own lives in doing so.
Absolutely. All the way. And all the other people down the line that have ever had anything to do with. And you, now here, you're helping me spread the word, which is something I believe in. We need a lot of improvement in our patriotism in this country. We are in a wonderful country that we live in, and you only have to see the results of occupation like occurred in the Philippines that other countries do to you, and what it might have been like had they been successful in doing that to us, including the Japanese and the Germans.
And, you know, on the topic of your injuries, what do you attribute your survival to?
I really think I'm a lucky recipient of modern medicine. I'm sure that's what did it. Penicillin. I think all my life to penicillin.
That you didn't get infection, gangrene,
yeah,
losing limbs.
Because in discussing this with doctors and so on, and what little I've read, in the Civil War, if you incurred a wound like this, you were gone unquestionably. That was it, in 10 days. In World War I, the best assessment any doctor has been able to tell me is that the calculated figures for a wound of this era was 2% in World War I. They didn't know what it would be in World War II because they had penicillin and they had sulfa. Well, here I am, so what's the percentage? Who knows?
Yeah.
But it's pretty good.
Well,
and I'm one of them.
Yeah, and you're still going. Well, I don't want to forget this. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. Have you ever had a moment where you resented what happened to you? Or you felt that it wasn't fair? Or you wished that it hadn't happened? Has it affected your life to that degree where you felt you didn't get a fair shake?
No, I don't think I ever looked at it that way. I do look at it like, Yeah, I'm a victim of fate. I wish I hadn't had to go through some of that stuff, but that's the luck of the draw. Because I've survived and I'm here and I've seen a lot of neat things since, I'm pretty darn lucky.
I had a feeling that was your perspective.
Yeah.
What would you say you're most proud of?
I guess I never really tried to analyze that thought of what I would be most proud of, but right now, off the cuff, I'd say I'm glad I was able to do something for my country.
And I know I've mentioned these totals of your descendants a few times, and I only do so because it's an impressive number, but the reality is none of them lived through any of this. So it's not as real for them as it was for you. For those of us who weren't alive during World War II, who didn't see any of this, who didn't understand what could have been and what almost was, what do you think we need to know about you and all the guys like you who risked their lives for our country?
I would like to hope that we could all be aware of what it took, of what it was and what they did, and order their lives accordingly, and also somehow gather the feeling that they too could make a contribution like that if they were called on to do that.
And the last thing I have to ask you, and feel free to add anything else, but you made it very clear how close you came to not coming home, to adding to that number of over 400,000 Americans who died in World War II. How often over the years have you thought about some of those guys you knew who didn't come home?
Almost every day. And it's kind of interesting. With the computer, it's been able to give me a greater understanding of what happened to some of them. For example, this Carmona that I mentioned, he lies in the Roswell Cemetery. He was given a Silver Star for his action the next day after I was wounded in killing the Japanese that stopped me. The other one that I turned up, I mentioned earlier that I stepped aside to let my BAR man shoot this first Japanese. He received a Distinguished Service Cross for his actions on March the 9th, along with Carmona, in subduing the Japanese strong point.
And am I understanding that they were both killed that day?
They were both killed. They were both awarded their awards, a Silver Star and Distinguished Service Cross, posthumously.
And with Carmona, so people remember, you're saying he was killed the day after you were hit, but what you shared with us is that he was one of those who helped save your life by cradling you and holding you upright so you didn't drown in your own blood.
Absolutely, and a day later he was dead. So I forever have a debt to him. I think about some of this stuff every day.
For a long time.
Yeah, and probably will. It's kind of tough. I keep telling my oldest son, I said, I don't know why in God's world I spend so much time thinking about it. And I think Cynthia probably gets tired of hearing me about it. And any of the grandkids that spend any time with me probably, well, it's a part of me. So,
yeah, and they wouldn't be here if you didn't survive it.
Yeah.
Hard to argue with that one.
I make a long story out of it. It sounds like a whole lot of things and so on. But remember, I was only in combat 5 months. Other guys, many, many other guys, were in those same circumstances, under those same dirty physical conditions, the mental strains, the whole work, for weeks and weeks and months and years. So they contributed far more than I ever did.
That's what I need to ask you. Whatever happened to the Pearsons in that prison camp?
Oh, well, I forgot to bring that point out, and I'm glad you brought that up. And that Mrs. Pearson died, Willard's wife died, little Mike died. Mr. Pearson, Willard, and Virginia and her husband came home.
Well, and I know you're not looking for attention or glory or credit, but you told me your motivation for wanting to go over there was the fact that they were imprisoned there, and you were part of the effort that liberated the Philippines and led to their liberation from that camp. Does that give you some satisfaction?
Yeah, it does. Oh, absolutely.
None of us really knows completely what happens when we breathe our last on Earth, but I imagine that just as Ralph Teason enjoyed a heavenly reunion with Tom Begley, that Patch Curtis has not only connected with the once-imprisoned Pearsons, but also had a chance to thank those fellow 1st Cavalry Division veterans who saved his life before giving their last full measure of devotion the very next day, 75 years ago. So here's my question. Is your perspective on life and liberty, on the freedom so many have fought and died for, and maybe even on the need for unity in our nation, has that perspective changed at all over the last hour? If so, it's just one more reason to be grateful for men like Ralph Thiessen and Patch Curtis. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we hear from a World War II Navy veteran who survived some of the Pacific's biggest battles. There's no doubt we'll be reminded again, as we are whenever we take the time to listen to our veterans of any vintage, that freedom is not free.